There's so many investors in the marketplace today that have a time horizon that is quite short. Should we be playing in the time horizon of 1 day to 1 second to even 1 month? Mm-hmm. I would say no. Our time horizon advantage is our clients are long-lived assets. Most of the people are investing for retirement for, even if they're in retirement, still have 20 years to live at retirement age or 30 years to live. Mm-hmm. And if they're earlier in their career, have a 50-year time horizon for their money. So we can harness some of those things that behaviorally other people can't do. We can do something that somebody that's concentrated on a month is not even going to pay attention to.
Welcome to the Russell Investments Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of investing. I'm Sophie Antal-Gibert, Consulting Director for Russell Investments Advisor and Intermediary Solutions Business. And today, we're going to talk about the joys and the challenges of investing in current markets without a crystal ball. You could argue that investing without a crystal ball that can precisely predict the future is never easy. And you'd probably be right. But it seems like the current environment is especially challenging. If you think about expensive valuations, the late economic cycle, shifting geopolitical risks, changing monetary policy regimes, and much more interconnected markets and economies today than ever before. To help us dive deeper into ways to potentially navigate today's market environment, I'm joined by Rob Balcoma, Senior Portfolio Manager of Multi-Asset Portfolios. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks, Sophie.
It's a pleasure to see you here in Seattle.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So, Rob, as a multi-asset portfolio manager, you are every single day surveying basically the entire publicly traded landscape, whether it's equities, fixed income, real assets, and even the securities and the strategies that fall in between those more traditional asset classes. I'm curious, when you look at today's investing landscape, what stands out to you? What gets you excited, and what gives you maybe pause for concern?
So I always start with the mindset of the risk manager. The global financial crisis was relatively early, first 5 years of my career. And so early in your career, it's always a formative thing when something that big happens. My colleague, Brian Meath, and I, we co-manage portfolios together, and he's a product of the 1990s bull market. And so his view is always, what's they're excited about? And mine's, how do we manage the risk? And there are things from the very high level, when I look at the landscape today, that concern me. And I start off with savings rates and rising inequality. Many people have seen the Gini coefficients around the globe. Inequality is the highest that it's been since really the 1920s. And so that's meant that a lot of people that are in their 40s, 50s, or even early 60s have little to no savings. And the global financial crisis has either wiped that out, or they haven't had the ability to save because of tough environments, working environments, or investing environments. It's very hard to provide financial security for people when the starting point is
challenging.
Poor.
Yeah.
So that's something that really I don't have a good answer for, but it's something at front of my mind. I think the second thing that I go to with our industry is the concerns around trust that people have after the global financial crisis. Our industry did not cover ourselves in glory in 2008 and coming out of that. And there were issues of fraud. We know the Bernie Madoff scandal, amongst others. But there were more micro ones as well, where things that we said didn't come true. And so from an industry perspective, trying to gain back trust, a concerns that the public is rightfully skeptical of our industry, and how do we gain that trust back on a daily basis by doing the right thing on their behalf little by little. And then the third thing from the industry that I think about on the concern side is more on the fees front. When I look at the landscape today, Vanguard is one of the few firms that's been growing rapidly. Indexing has been rising rapidly in popularity, whether it's ETFs or index funds. And that's meant downward pressure on fees, which I think is a really good thing for clients overall. But the asset management industry needs to figure out how they operate in an environment like that.
That's really helpful insight from an industry perspective. What about from a market perspective? How does it look there?
From the markets, the cycle dynamics today are ones where we have the Fed raising interest rates within the U.S. We have an economic expansion that's one of the longest in history, and U.S. equity valuations are the highest that they've been outside of a couple instances in the last 150 years.
So, yeah, which are not flattering instances, sort of 1929. Right?
The market problems are paramount, but I'll put my happy cap on for a little bit and channel my inner Brian Meath. When I think about the industry, the financial industry's always been one that rightly or wrongly, has innovated, and acronyms, whether it's CLOs or CDOs or various structured product, has been the innovation of the past. And I think what we're starting to see is a pivot in the industry that 2008 caused people to stop caring about excess returns or down 26 in a down 28 environment and really started caring about solutions more. And that to me is heartening.
Sort of more holistically, maybe, about the client that's behind this portfolio that we're managing. It's not just digits on a spreadsheet.
Exactly. Digits on a spreadsheet or trying to beat a market or others in the marketplace for the sake of winning or for the sake of making money on your own behalf. We're now thinking about what's the client objective that we're trying to achieve. Take a more consultative approach as an industry as a whole. And we've seen that from the advisor level. We've seen it at the bigger institutional level in within finance as well. So there's been an innovation. Sometimes that's been bad in the past. This innovation seems more towards, oh, if I want someone that's wanting an impact on their community and their environment, impacting investing or a sustainable investing portfolio, or I need income in retirement, how do I provide that income without having a big drawdown that increases sequence of return risk? And so there's
it's
really
like the innovation is almost coming more. The source of it is doing right by the investor, as opposed to
how can we make more money?
exactly.
So that's the positive. The other positive is the foil to the fees of how the industry operates in a dynamic of lower fees. The end investor eats net of fee returns. We know that net of taxes are a huge thing. And if tax dollars are away from you, your after tax return is really what you can live
That's
off of.
Actually what you can spend.
And it's your after fee that you live off of. And so this dynamic is a really exciting one where the investor is getting more of the return because of the lower fees within the marketplace. From the markets, the excitement comes from a couple different areas. One, I would say the dispersion as you get later in a market cycle occurs more and more. 2017 was a pretty low volatility environment. We've started to see, and I've referenced some of these numbers in the past, but energy was up 10% last quarter, financials was down 8%. That type of dispersion allows some of the active management environment to be a bit better if we have a good hit rate, if we do have success in the managers that we're picking. And so both from our own decisions as well as the investment managers, there's potential on a go-forward basis as volatility increases to really make more money on behalf of clients and really show our worth. So that's one, higher volatility. The second I would say is in this U.S., non-U.S. Bet. When I look at the valuation differentials between these two, they're some of the widest that we've seen in history. And so I look at that as an opportunity for an investor that has a 5 to 7 year time horizon. It's not a 1 to 2 year bet. It's not something that
it's not the next 6 months.
Exactly. But it's if you're a long term investor with patience, valuation on your side is a really good long term magnet to pull you towards. And the U.S. valuations and Europe and Japan valuations will pull towards each other. And that could mean U.S. coming down in terms of valuations. It could mean Europe and Japan and emerging markets going up. But over the long term, history has shown they converge.
Yeah. So, Rob, at Russell Investments, obviously part of the way that we manage portfolios is that we research and then select and combine money managers that we believe have expertise in distinct parts of the market. To what extent is this sort of multi-manager approach helping you deliver on client outcomes today?
We've been doing some pretty cool things with the managers that we've been dealing with. Anyone can go to a mutual fund and buy a manager off the shelf and say that this is a great money manager. They've got a 20-year track record. XYZ has shown time and time again they're Morningstar gold rated and fantastic. And we love those managers just like everybody else. But there's been more and more where we've pulled out pieces of manager portfolios and we've been a little bit better about saying, I really like them for their top 20 names and those other 80 that they have, that's dead weight that we need to cut. And so I think the research team as well as our portfolio management team within Russell has found some cool stuff. One is in the prepayment risk area that we've talked about within mortgages. As interest rates rise, people are less likely to prepay their mortgage. We've carved that out of a manager's broader portfolio that it was maybe 5% of their portfolio. We made it 100% for us and gave it today in some of our funds, a 15% allocation.
Oh, wow.
So it's really that ability to take what you like of the money manager and avoid the rest.
So I'm thinking, I mean, all of that is a very complex picture. As a multi-asset portfolio manager, you really do have access to so many different opportunities and ways of structuring a portfolio. I wonder, how do you distill all of those opportunities and risks when you're managing portfolios, and especially when you then layer on sort of the uncertainties and complexity and volatility of today? How do you know where to go first? How do you block and tackle?
There are so many different areas of opportunities that we can go around the globe within various asset classes. It really is daunting to have to be the expert on all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. And so I can admit I am not the expert on each individual segment. We have the resourcing, fortunately, to have an expert in all of these areas. So Sam Pittman on asset allocation, he's one of the top in the industry. He's writing papers in various articles, getting published. I rely heavily on him for asset allocation decisions, and we partner together where I bring one perspective, he brings another, and we can move forward. On fixed income, Yoshie Phillips within the manager research side on below investment grade corporate credit, she's going to know those managers way better than I do and better than most other people in the industry. So I need to bring to bear those decisions from them, get them implemented in our portfolio in the most efficient way possible. Sometimes that means decisions within Russell. Other times it means knowing what to outsource and what to do ourselves. And so, as you know, we hire money managers to make decisions. And I'm never going to know as well as the money managers, Apple versus Google versus IBM versus Samsung. Those money managers, that's all they do. We hire the best in the world to do that. And
or ones that we believe are
or
the best.
Or we believe are the best, sorry. They have more insights than I do. And so I shouldn't be making those decisions. They should be making those.
That's one aspect of Russell Investments that I have always really appreciated. We don't want to compromise the the outcome for the client by being overly proud. We're willing to work with others that are better than us in certain areas, or that we believe are better than us in certain areas.
One of the other mantras that we have is first do no harm. We don't want to mess up a long-term plan by doing something tactically that seems like a good idea at the time, but skews things for long-term outcomes. And so I guess on the first principle side of things, it's decisions that point at most insight. It's learning from the money managers. But there's also other first principles that we want to instill. And one of them that's big for us is time horizon. We do have somewhat of a time horizon advantage where our clients and us care a little bit less about shorter term tracking risk and can focus more on the outcome and the long term path towards the objective that they're trying to achieve.
So if those are the first principles, how are you modifying that, or where are you placing some additional care potentially today? Like, are you running different sort of risk scenarios or risk models, for instance, to help you model if this happens, then how might our portfolio be affected, especially in today's, slightly more volatile environment?
We like to talk about three different lenses that we use to analyze the portfolio. There's the fundamental lens, there's the risk-based lens, and there's the historical returns-based lens. And so each one of those provides a different subset of information. The historical performance, how are we doing in up or down markets? How do we do in the last five drawdowns given the positioning today? What happened when interest rates were rising versus falling, and how were we performing? Those types of things allow us to say on a realized basis, what is the true portfolio doing? How is it behaving? Is it behaving the way I want it to be? So if I think, and nominally I'm overweight to emerging markets, but when emerging markets wins, on those days I lose,
mm-hmm.
there's a sensitivity coming through that is unexpected that I need to correct for and make sure that the portfolio reflects that. Same thing on the fundamental side. We talk a lot about valuations or earnings growth rates or what the duration is of the portfolio. All the fundamentals, when from the bottom up, when we put them all together, we want those to be aligned with the risk scenario that we're seeing going forward. So credit risk is a good example, where fundamentally, what are the different credit buckets that we have exposure to today? If we want to be up in quality and we look at the fundamentals and we're not up in quality overall, we're not having higher liquidity, we're not in better ratings companies, something's wrong. And so from a fundamental lens, we can see that. From a performance-based lens, we could see, are we outperforming when higher quality outperforms lower quality? And then from the risk model, that third lens, we can say, what if I stress test spreads and blow them out by 100 basis points? Do we outperform? So across those three lenses, it allows us to really get in the weeds and see how we're performing and what the fundamentals say and what the risk models say. We also have attribution to say, now these positions that we've had and these views that we had, are they coming through to fruition and in what size and what magnitude? I always like to think about kind of a batting average and slugging percentage, to use the baseball side of things. Are we getting more percentage of the things that we do right rather than wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And are the ones that we get right, are we getting really right so that they might have a big impact on the portfolio? And are we limiting losses? So those things that we get wrong, are they acceptable failure rather than unacceptable failure?
So it sounds like you always are focusing on those three lenses of fundamental risk and historical returns, no matter the market environment. I'm curious, though, are you applying those lenses differently in today's market environment than you might have a few years ago?
The what we're doing today is interesting. What we've done, which is we couldn't have done this 5 to 7 years ago, and Stas Melnikov, who's our risk manager on the team within Russell, he's done a tremendous amount of work, ability to customize our risk model to say, let me dream up a scenario and say, I think this might happen. How would we do?
Mm-hmm.
And it takes all the different holdings of the portfolio, stresses them through those 15 different elements
of your scenario.
Bond yields are going up by this, equities are going down. So in the last...
And Argentina defaults and...
Exactly.
Antarctica falls into the ocean.
So the one that we've been talking more and more about and came through in January and February was interest rates rising at the same time as markets going down.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that we haven't seen in a very long time, and we want to understand how the portfolio behaves in that environment. There's not a lot of assets when bonds are going down and equities are going down that can do well. The prepayment risk strategy that we have came about from that. So you look at all the different risk scenarios and sensitivities. What if equities are going down? What if interest rates are going up? What can do well? And so historically, commodities have done pretty well in that environment, and we've seen the energy sector really do well in this period of rising interest rates and equity chop. And prepayment risk has done really well. So we're trying to find those things that are different. The risk models and the stresses that we can come up with lead in a circular motion back to idea generation and really pushing the analysts. And this is where, back to the point of most insight, if I'm open enough about a need and something, we've got so many smart people that they go around and start looking and uncovering rocks, and it's really cool to see what they come up with.
So when you were citing some of the risks that you've been paying attention to and how you define risk, one thing I noticed is that you haven't talked much about geopolitical risk. So for instance, today's trade wars or skirmishes or whatever, disagreements, whatever we want to call them. I mean, I imagine that those are hard to model. So as great as our risk models are, it is hard to model a lot of that sort of stuff because they can be unpredictable and very fluid. But on the other hand, I mean, do you factor those into investment decisions? And if we don't, then what's the risk of that?
We can't have a tail risk dictate how we manage the central scenario of our portfolio. But we can think about the various scenarios. So specific to your trade war example, our strategist put out a blog post, an internal blog post about these are the four different scenarios. These are probabilities that we expect. These are potential drawdowns, how it would change our cycle scores, the economic impact. And so we're debating and talking about all these all the time. What actually is going to happen in the next 12 months is going to be different than any of those four scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
Decidedly going to be different and could be different in a very different way than we even expect it's going to be different. And so there's only so much you can do in that arena. What we can do, though, is think about our best estimation of how bad it could be and then go a little bit worse than that and think about, is that acceptable or unacceptable for our clients? Invariably, there are going to be times where we have that unacceptable failure because that surprise comes about and it's bigger than we would have ever expected. But we can't manage to that because managing to risk, one of the things that there's been lots of studies on is there's a volatility risk premium. If you pay for protection in the marketplace through options in your portfolio, you're paying so much away that you lose over time because markets go up more than they go down. And so sometimes when you're managing risk, you can manage away the return portion of that in combination with the risk. You've managed every risk and you've managed away every return. So in this industry, we need to be optimistic enough. We need to be realistic. And there are times where we need to take risk, times where we need to manage risk. Certain ones that are so small and have a low probability, we shouldn't be working into the portfolio in our view because we can't predict them. Nobody can predict them. What we can do is once they occur, react and see where there's been dislocation. And that's what we've done in the past. We didn't expect Trump to win the election. We didn't expect Brexit to happen. Many people did not. But when when Brexit occurred, we hired a UK manager, played that dislocation and found great stock selection opportunities within the UK. when the Trump election happened and emerging markets sold off by 15%, we bought more emerging market risk and were able to get some on the rebound. When a trade war has occurred in these past couple of weeks, we've reacted as well. And so there are certain things that you can plan in advance for, you can make projections about, and we do. But there inevitably are things that are surprising. And if you manage every risk, you start to reduce your overall returns.
If you could, speaking of the future, if you could receive one piece of information about the future right now, what would you choose to find out about? And this is more related to your portfolio. So, for instance, would it be an election outcome? Would it be the path of interest rates, inflation, maybe the fate of a particular company or industry or sector, or maybe it's something about a factor?
Yeah, this is a really tricky one, and because I'm a kid in a candy shop, if you just told me you could
that's
have
you
the
can
future,
only
I'm,
pick one.
I'm the Back to the Future guy. I'm Biff, and I've got the Farmer's Almanac now. What would I do with that? So if price is not an option, so if I couldn't say the S&P is at X, if we're just looking at economic data or something that's more fundamental, I think if I was to know the U.S. versus emerging market growth rate differential and whether it was accelerating or decelerating, I think that would be a pretty good one.
That would be a bit of a key to the kingdom for you at the moment, at least.
Right now, where we see the forward-looking returns for most U.S. assets, forward-looking returns have us going towards non-U.S. assets. We do have non-U.S. overweights and have some EM positions that are bigger than peers, but we haven't gone whole hog into that area because of some concerns around trade wars, because of some concerns around interest rate differentials and flight of capital, because of growth rates changing and the U.S. really steaming ahead with the tax cuts.
So, Rob, hearing you talk about these different scenarios and the way that you think about portfolios and all of the different tools that you have available, it seems like the heart of a lot of the conundrum that you face as a portfolio manager, both the conundrum on the positive and on the sort of challenging side, is this tension between, on the one hand, having this risk of loss that you're trying to manage, and on the other hand, you have this risk of missing out on potential opportunities too.
FOMO.
So, yeah, the fear of missing out, right? So how do you balance that? Because obviously you and our investors want as much return as possible, yet at the same time, that return comes with risk. And as you said, not all of it is stomachable, right? Investors can't always stay the course. It's sort of like you want to be at the party for as long as possible, but you want to make sure that you make a strategic exit before markets crash and before the sort of cleanup crew arrives, because being part of a cleanup crew at the end of a party is never a lot of fun. So how do you walk that balance?
Yeah, I think the starting point is the process grounded in the knowledge that you're not going to pick the bottoms, you're not going to pick the top, and evolving slowly through time is the way that we can more often than not get to the better outcome. And so that means slowly selling on the way up and slowly buying on the way down. I think part of it, though, is also knowing yourself. So and knowing who you are as an investor and that risk of loss versus risk of missing out, and what is for you as an investor, what is behaviorally more acceptable? It's very easy for me as an investor. I like, as a value investor, it's very easy for me to buy something that's cheap. It's very hard for me to sell a cheap asset that has deteriorating fundamentals that's going to get cheaper. And so the process that we've worked out and for our team tries to align with what we can do successfully as investors. Controlling the motions through process and rigor and repeatability is one angle. Another is knowing behaviorally the behavioral mistakes that you're most attuned to, have a process that tries to correct for those and aligns with those ones that are natural to you as an investor. The other thing is having clients that and client communication that's clear and straightforward and having transparency. And it's one of the things that we need to get better at. We need to continue to provide more transparency. But the more we can talk through positions of reasons and rationale, talk through time horizon, make sure that we're all in this together, the more it's survivable for them, the more it's survivable for us. Because one of the real challenges within the industry is managing kind of the tracking error risk, the shorter term deviation from everybody else in the herd with outcome risk. And so it's like a career risk of being different than everybody else versus not meeting the end objective. And so it's very hard for an investor to get a 5% return when everybody else is getting 15. But at the end of the day, that might be much better for you over the long term. That's a smoother path. It's more survivable.
Well, Rob, thank you very much for your time today, and thank you for sharing your insights on how to consider investing in today's markets without that proverbial crystal ball. If I was going to attempt to summarize your thoughts, I'd say that no matter the prevailing market environment, but especially in times of market uncertainty like today, investors should probably consider four things. One, deploying active management strategies that can find those gem investment opportunities in the midst of turmoil, or at least attempt to find them. Second, diversifying beyond your home borders and across asset classes, so including those equities, fixed income, alternatives such as real estate, infrastructure, and commodities, but also looking into strategies that fall in between those traditional asset classes, such as you mentioned, bank loans, mortgages, preferred securities. A third strategy to consider is being very intentional about every single exposure throughout the entire investment process, starting from how you're designing a portfolio's asset allocation to constructing an investable portfolio of money managers and strategies, and then to dynamically managing that portfolio on a daily basis. And lastly, applying rigor and objectivity to risk analysis through the use of stress tests, perspectives from peers inside and outside the firm, a robust approach to forecasting, and surrounding yourself with the other team members that have very complementary skills and outlooks. We hope this conversation has provided you with some insight into how we at Russell Investments are thinking about the current investment landscape, and we hope we gave you some food for thought as you think about your own portfolios. Thank you for joining us today, and we will be back again soon with another episode of the Russell Investments Podcast. You've been listening to the Russell Investments Deep Dive Podcast. I'm Sophie Antel-Gibert. If you like this podcast and want to hear more like it, please subscribe to our podcast on either iTunes or SoundCloud. Thanks for listening. This podcast was recorded on July 10th, 2018.